pal. So tonight, this time of year is a very powerful time of year. Not everybody notices it. Millions and millions and millions of people are running around tonight doing what everybody always does on Friday. But it is an anniversary, and it is the 71st anniversary of something very important, and that is the liberation of Auschwitz. And 71 years ago, things happened that are really unspeakable, beyond comprehension. If you want to get a sense of how incomprehensible it really is when you walk out for Onyx Shabbat tonight, I want you, when you're going by our glass windows, you will see cylinders, beautiful glass cylinders, filled with very colorful buttons. Those buttons are part of a collection of what we hope will one day be 1.5 million buttons. Right now we have around 250,000. These really hold a fraction of that. It's probably not more than 50,000 buttons in what you see, maybe even less. And you'll get an idea that each one of those represents a Jewish child who died in the Holocaust. Actually, let's rephrase that. Each one of those represents a Jewish child that was murdered in the Holocaust. They just didn't die. Someone caused them to die. And while many of our people perished under the most horrible of circumstances, many survived. They went on against unbelievable odds to somehow find a way to live. And they went on and made lives for themselves and had children and affirmed life, and their children went on to accomplish great things. And, you know, Hitler did not succeed. He lost. We lost. But ultimately, he lost more. And we are still here. And to talk to us tonight a little bit about what the experiences were like, and against such odds that people survived with such will and courage and strength, we have a very special speaker. He's one of our own. He's a member of our synagogue. He has spoken here before. His name is Dr. Sheldon Konigsberg. He is a person who, if you ever had the privilege of speaking with him at Kiddush or, you know, after lunch, has much to say about a great many things. He's always interesting. He's always a gentleman. And he's always a mensch. And he is always has a story to tell that will, believe me, it will be one you will never forget. It's our privilege to invite Dr. Konigsberg to address us this evening. Shelley?
Those of you who saw the promo of this talk saw a picture of my parents. That was actually on their wedding day. The picture was taken in Munich, where my parents were interned in a displaced persons camp. My father had given a Russian paratrooper two bottles of vodka, in exchange for which he got a men's suit and a parachute. My mother took the men's suit, and she made it into the outfit you see in the picture. And she used the parachute. Russian parachutes were made of pure silk in those days. And she used that to sew together her trousseau. That was my parents' wedding picture. When the Great Synagogue of Munich was rededicated on the anniversary of Kristallnacht, just after the end of the war, the chief rabbi, who actually married my parents, kicked out the German news reporters, indicating who had come specially to see what was going on. Mark Clark was on the dais and various other Allied generals. And he refused to allow the German press to cover the event. He threw them out. And he said that, yes, it's true that they had nothing to do with the lighting of the fires that destroyed the synagogue. Neither did they in any way advocate for people to bring water to put the fires out. Shame on them all, he screamed, and he threw them out in the presence of the Allied dignitaries present for the occasion. My mother was born in Eastern Europe in a small town that was originally part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Her father went to university in Vienna. He became an economist. And ultimately, he established a brewery in what became Eastern Poland. Her mother was a teacher. Her uncle owned the electrical company of all of Eastern Poland. Her grandparents had a landed estates, a granite quarry. She herself planned on becoming a doctor and began her first year of medical school in Poland in Krakow. Then in September 1939, World War II started. Poland was invaded by Germany from the east and from the west, and Russia from the east. Her family fell under the Russian part, and her second year of medical school was actually in Russian. The Russians took all of the property, all of their money, all of everything, put my mother's entire family in her previous bedroom. In her previous bedroom, there was, in fact, 10 people living in there. And then there were 10 other families living in the other rooms of the house. My mother was very blessed, she said, because after all, even though they lost every single thing that they owned, the Russians could care less what they did as long as they weren't political, and so they kept them alive. And then in 1941, after conquering most of Europe, Hitler double-crossed Stalin and he invaded east into Russia. 2 weeks after the outbreak of the invasion, everything changed as the Germans advanced and took control of the area where they lived. All the Jews were required to leave their home and move into a controlled area of the city known as the ghetto. They gave my mother's entire family into one room, not quite her bedroom, a room maybe a quarter the size of her bedroom. And by this time, my mother's grandfather had already been killed, as well as her uncle's wife. Ultimately, of the 62 members of my mother's family, only two survived the war. During the day, everyone went to work. My mother worked in the town for the local Nazi commandant, both inside the house and tending to his adjacent fields. Every now and then, usually at night, the Germans would announce something called an Aktion, or action, and just go into the town, into the ghetto, and round up Jews and take them off to the concentration camps. Over and over, the actions tended to occur more and more frequently. To hide themselves, the family built a bunker in the cellar, another one in the attic, and every night two people kept watch, waiting to see if the SS would show up to cart away more Jews. One time while they were hiding in the attic, a small baby began to cry. The mother literally suffocated the child to prevent the Germans from knowing that they were there. Another time when they came, my mother actually coughed, and amazingly, a flock of pigeons happened to fly overhead at precisely that moment. And so the Germans initially went into the house and realized it was just the pigeons and went on. That's how they survived. Food was hard to get. My mother was working for a Nazi commandant, and domestic as opposed to in medical school. She was able to get bread and potatoes. And while she was cleaning, her best friend was killed in another Aktion, or action. My mother's younger sister was still alive. She was 10. She had 7 or 8 girlfriends. And every night, my mother was the school teacher and taught them various subjects, including giving them homework, believe it or not, because otherwise they would all be illiterate. My grandmother, my mother's mother, overheard this and the girls all complained, "Why are you bothering to teach us all that stuff? They're going to kill us anyway." And she said that if any one of you survive, you'll at least be able to know what to say and who to say it to. Most of those girls died, unfortunately. One day, my grandfather and my grandmother, my mother's parents, were walking in the ghetto on the sidewalk. The Germans came by, promptly took my grandmother and knocked her down onto the ground, and took my grandfather and took a rifle and smashed out his eye. Later, when they left, they were able to secure a doctor, a Jewish doctor, inside the ghetto, and 5 men held down my grandfather after a bottle of vodka, as the doctor had to operate to take out the damaged eye. Had he not done that, the other eye would have been affected. My mother had recurrent nightmares, of course, of her father's screams in the night. 1 year later, in June 3rd or 4th of 1943, the Germans declared that the ghetto was to be judenfrei, that is, completely free of Jews. They rounded up all the Jews working in the town, had them stripped naked, and my mother watched as her uncle was killed before her eyes. Imagine a huge line of people, and the Germans are taking automatic weapons and literally killing everybody as they're going. And the man comes to my mother, and he stops. There was my mother, a young woman with long blonde hair and blue eyes, a typical Aryan woman, and he said he couldn't kill her because she looked exactly like his own daughter. So he sent her off naked into the fields. Everyone else before and after was murdered. My mother ran into the forest. They came to an area where they had had a treehouse when they were children, and people knew about it, my mother and some of her friends, and they all hid in the treehouse. A local forest ranger, a German, happened to see the hiding, a Pole, happened to see the Jews who were hiding, and at peril to his own life, he decided to help them. Once a week, he would bring them a loaf of bread, a few vegetables. For a little bit of money, they gave him some blankets and comforter. After about a month of this, the Germans heard that there were Jews hiding in the forest. They took in the forest ranger, and they interrogated him for a whole day. He did not break. He did not reveal that he had been hiding Jews. After this event, he told this to my mother and her father, and that they would have to leave because within a few days, they were going to scour through the entire forest. By then, several of the boys hiding with my mother's family, including my mother's boyfriend, had been killed while looking for food in the neighboring village. My mother ran in the town, and she went to visit this guy named Max, who was a Ukrainian who was working with her in the commandant's house. And he agreed to take her in, and her father, and her mother, and her cousin, because he felt sorry for them. We learned later that this particular Max in the other town used to round up Jews and murder them for sport. But her, he liked. So he kept her in his house in the cellar, gave her food, and convinced his daughters that these were just friends of his and it should be their special secret. Because obviously if the Germans found out that a Ukrainian was hiding Jews, he would have been gone himself. The Germans continued to round up people. And the noose just kept getting tighter and tighter. Max told him that he had an idea that perhaps if they masqueraded as Ukrainians, there was work for domestics in Germany. And so he convinced my mother's mother and her younger sister to go on a train in a few days and go east to Germany and masquerading as Ukrainians. They were Poles, but they certainly knew Ukrainian. And so on September 20th of 1943, my mother's mother, her sister, and a cousin went on a train bound for Germany with plans for my mother to follow in a few days. However, Max could not help her father. Remember, her grandfather, my grandfather, her father, with one eye and quite destitute. And he decided rather than having the Germans kill him, he would just go off into the woods and just hope something happens. So there he is running through the countryside. And he comes to a clearing, and there's a large farm and a farmhouse. And he says, what the heck? So he goes walking down the hill into the farmhouse in the valley. At this point, two things happen. First, the farmer's dog begins to bark, and the farmer comes out to see who was there. And then for reasons that are totally inexplicable, all of a sudden, a huge flock of birds flies overhead. And the farmer sees the dog, the flock of birds, and this worn-out, beaten-down Jew. He was an illiterate man, but he was also very religious. And he actually took this as a sign that God had told him to help this man. And so he agreed to take him in, and also to take in my mother, who, remember, hadn't quite gone yet over to the east. They went into their lands. They dug a pit. The pit was not quite tall enough for people to stand. It had a bucket for a bathroom, one candle, an amount of earth for a pillow and wood over it where the cattle used to come every night in order to graze. Luckily, none of the cattle ever stepped in through the wood. Every few weeks, the farmer would go into town, and he would take some of the coins that my grandfather had hidden on his clothing, and he gave them bought food and brought it all back. One night, apparently in the bunker, my grandfather started to cry. He had a dream, and in the dream he saw a plant with a big leaf and a small one, and they both fell down. And he told my mother that that meant that his wife and his daughter had been killed. Very interesting intuition. On Christmas Day, the cousins of the farmer all came to celebrate, which meant that the farmer couldn't go out to the ditch over the cattle field, which meant that they had no food for 2 to 3 days and no nothing and almost died. In a recurring dream of my mother, the greatest of all riches was freedom from hunger. It is a table with a large round bread and a knife, and she could actually cut off as much food as she wanted to. One day, a newspaper arrived, and my mother read that the Germans had been defeated at Stalingrad. When the Russians were close by, the farmer told them to leave, reminding them that no one should know that he had hidden Jews, because if the country people found out that a Polish farmer had hidden Jews, they would kill him. He also warned them that if the war ever ended, they should never write to him because he was illiterate, and he would have to bring the letter into someone else to read, and they would find out, in fact, that he'd been harboring Jews. Quite an interesting thing, is it not? Humanity and inhumanity. At 4 a.m, my grandfather and my mother left the bunker. My mother said she had wished only to have a bunker the size of Saddam Hussein's bunker in Iraq. It was much smaller and did not exactly have air conditioning. At this point, after they left, the Germans lost the counteroffensive. They went east. They went to another town. The Russians counterattacked. Ultimately, the war ended, and they were free. A Russian military truck took them to the newly free town of Tarnopol, which then was Poland. It is now a part of the Ukraine. And a notice on in the town hall indicated that the Russian Officers Club was looking for a bookkeeper. My grandfather, the economist, remember, applied for a job as a bookkeeper with his assistant, my mother, wearing a burlap skirt made from a potato sack and wooden shoes. It was there that she met the manager of the Russian Officers Club, himself a survivor. That was my father. Before the consummate darkness descended over Europe, my father, who lived in Poland, was a skilled craftsman. He owned a furniture establishment, and at age 27, he was looking to a future. He had an apprentice, which was his younger brother, 9 years younger, and the two of them had a large furniture shop in Tarnopol on a hill. World War II began with the invasion of Poland, if you remember, and it was invaded from two sides, the Russians on the west, the Germans on the east. They were allies. When they went and they both invaded, it was not so clear where the dividing line was going to be between the Russian part and the German part. The local townspeople, who were Polish at the time, were pretty certain that the area of Poland where they lived was going to go to the German side rather than to the Russian side. And so they decided to give the Germans a present. And they went into the countryside and found a very rich Jewish farmer and his entire entourage and surrounded the farm, set it on fire, and killed everyone and threw them in a dung heap. When the final lines were drawn, they had made a mistake. And that, in fact, turned out to be in the Russian sector. Within a few weeks after the Russians took control, the farmer's 10-year-old boy, who had escaped from this massacre by hiding in a hayloft, came out, went down and reported this crime to the authorities. There was a trial. My father was sitting in the back of the trial. So there was the ringleader of this horrific murder. I think he killed a total of 40 people. And the female Russian prosecutor asked him, just as a matter of personal interest, what his feeling is about people and events in general, and wondered if maybe the family had a family dog for his children. He said, yes. Well, dogs don't live very long, and after a dog dies, what do you do about it? Do you just throw it away? Or he said, no, the sensibilities of his children are very important. And so we usually make a special ceremony. We dig a grave for the dog. We say a few prayers over the dog, and so on. Prosecutor then wondered how interesting it was that this man thought more about the dogs than he did about human beings who he threw into a dung heap, which he set on fire, and that's where they found all the bodies. Execute them all, she screamed, and that's what happened. The Russians sent my father to school to learn Russian and the communist system in order to help run their furniture factories. His classmate in school was a Russian colonel who would prove very useful to him later on. More of this later. And then, of course, Germany invaded. My father was sent to a work camp, which the Germans built on the grounds of his grandfather's farm. He was spared from death only by his skilled craftsmanship, including reupholstering the seats of trains and also of Mercedes-Benz automobiles for the German general staff. At one point, while he was working down in the town, which he was allowed to do during the day, there was another action. Remember those, where they rounded people up? He was rounded up. He was thrown into one of those cattle cars and taken to the Sobibor extermination camp. If you can recall having ever seen one of these cattle cars, they don't look like American cattle cars. It's basically a car with one window. The window is about 12 inches by 12, and it has barbed wire on the window. My father described it explicitly, and when I saw one at the National Holocaust Museum, it was amazing how accurate his description was. They didn't search my father very well, and he had a pair of old rusty pliers. And so while they were going through the countryside, he managed with the pliers to pry open the barbed wire on the window. And he and a whole bunch of other people jumped out of the train in the middle of the night. Of course, the Germans were on top of the train. They stopped the train. They rounded everyone up and machine gunned everyone down in the middle of the night, including my father. So there my father wakes up at about 3 or 4 in the morning, blood everywhere, with a bullet wound in the back of his neck. They had missed. They'd knocked him out, but they hadn't killed him. In his mind, he thought that he had actually, he was in hell rather than anywhere else, but no one else was there. And so he climbed out among the bodies and went off into the forest. But there was no food. There was nothing to eat. There was no place to live. So in the end, he wound up smuggling himself back into the work camp where he had come from in the first place. The commandant of the camp was a man named Königsbauer. Our name is Königsberg. He thought that perhaps in a prior lifetime we might have been relatives. He made my father his translator because he spoke perfect German in addition to Polish. Poles didn't normally speak German. And he decided to send him off to make furniture for his mother, who was an Austrian baroness. So Madame Königsbauer was not a Nazi, and she didn't agree with what her son was doing in the camp, and she told my father so. He made her several couches and a few other things, and she told him that she was very upset that one day her son and all of his compatriots would be judged harshly for the crimes that they had committed on human beings. She warned him of the timing of the liquidation of the concentration camp, and the inmates dug a tunnel. And before the actual day of the liquidation, they all escaped out of the tunnel. Very few survived, but a few did, including my father and actually his brother Irving, his apprentice, remember, at the furniture shop. My father wound up hiding in a sewer under a Crusader's castle in what is now the Ukraine. His brother, who also escaped, also came separately to the same Crusader's castle. And there they were, down in the sewer system, going around. Each had a rifle and wondering who was going to be around the next turn. After all, it could have been anybody. It could have been an SS officer. Could have been the Ukrainian police, who like to go to those things in order to kill Jews. And so there they are, my father with his rifle, my uncle and his friend with his rifle, and they're both heading in the tunnel towards the intersection, thinking that they're, as soon as whoever comes across the intersection, they're going to kill him. At that moment, for some strange reason, my uncle happened to whisper something in Yiddish to his friend who was with him, and my father heard the words and wondered if it was his brother. He called out to him, and of course it was. Another step, they each would have killed each other. But they reconciled, obviously, and they hid in the tunnel under the Crusader's castle. They hid in that tunnel with the pestilence for months. My father described waking up every morning in the sewer, and he had a shirt on, and his dark shirt was turned white by the lice. He would go into the local sewage water. He'd dip his shirt into the water, take it out. The lice would be gone. The next day, it would happen again. Of the 20 people who were in the sewer, only 3 wound up alive. My father, his brother, and a very close friend of theirs named Ben. And he died a few weeks later of disease. Everyone else was killed. Only a few from force of arms. Most were killed because they asked themselves, what's the point of resisting? What's the point of fighting? We're all going to die anyway. And they basically gave up. They gave up. Then the Russians counterattack. They liberate Tarnopol. My father and his brother crawl out from the sewer. I can't even imagine what they looked like. And my father sees a vehicle going down the street, and he recognizes the colonel in the back of the military vehicle. It was his classmate from before who called himself Colonel Flabovsky. His real name was Feinlieb. And he made him the manager of the Russian Officers Club, which is how he met my mother. The Russians also sent them back to school to learn more about the Russian system. And my father described in vivid detail a lecture given by the guest lecturer in political science, who was Nikita Khrushchev. Khrushchev at that time was the president of the Ukraine, and he actually ran the war day to day for Stalin. And he drew a map of the world on a blackboard. And he put a circle around Vietnam and Laos and Cambodia and discussed that the strategy of the Soviet Union to defeat the West would be to divert the attention of the West towards little wars and suck up their resources. My father told me about this in 1957, before these events historically happened. He lived to see the speech come true. It was amazing how accurate the man was. And he also realized that just like in the case of the Germans, the people in charge who knew of these plans did not learn the lessons of history, and they did not act. When my father was in ghetto, he and his friend Ben was the guy who was in the tunnel and died, he and his friend Ben went to shul for services. At this point, the Nazis decided it was time to help clean out the ghetto. They surrounded the shul, set the shul on fire, took automatic weapons, and began killing every single person in the shul. My father and his friend were much more agile than some of the older people. They climbed up onto the balcony, punched a hole in the window, and climbed out onto a tree that was sitting there and watched what was happening down below as everyone was being murdered. The rabbi, whom my father knew since childhood, went to the Aron Kodesh, took out a Sefer Torah, and began screaming at the top of his lungs, "Where are you? Where are you?"
I've been your loyal servant for all of my life. I followed your mitzvot. Where are you? Machine gun fire continued. He took the Torah and threw it in the fire, and he was killed. He had lost his faith in the end. My father lived a very long life. He died when he was 1 month shy of his 96th birthday. At his funeral, we received a message that an Israeli general, the Israeli head of the Friends of the IDF, had heard my father had died, and he was flying in from Atlanta, and he wanted to speak at the funeral. Neither I nor my brother nor my mother, who was alive at the time, had any idea what this was all about. After the usual commemorations, the general spoke, and he said these words, "While everyone now knows what kind of man he is and was, let me tell you what he did." The general then described in great detail the following statement, that he said every soldier in the Israeli army actually knew my father's name, because during the treacherous time of the Jenin uprising on the West Bank, my father found out that the Israeli army did not have sufficient flak jackets to protect the soldiers. So he personally contacted a group of his business associates. They raised money, and they supplied the entire Israeli army with protective gear. No plaques, no awards, no commemorations, just an astounding donation by anonymous. My father even kept the extent of this from his own family. In his mind, it was enough for the terrorists to know that there were Jews in America who would step up to protect their own. Zohar. We hear that word all the time. For my parents, it meant not just remembering the barbarism of past events. It was also to dedicate ourselves so that never again we place ourselves in the kind of vulnerable position of not being able, not being willing to defend ourselves. So then, what exactly is faith? For my parents, faith was the will to survive against all odds, to have strength and resolve even in the face of the ultimate adversity, to never give up. One could argue that with God's graces, they came to see the truth of this and to realize that immortality is the continuance of a sacred trust in all of our descendants. That miracle, despite all that has happened and all that may yet happen, remains a simple truth that endures throughout the ages. Am Yisrael Chai. The people Israel live. Amen.